the product carbon footprint world will very, very rapidly outpace the emissions factor world. Let's take a good example. There's basically one beef emissions factor that pretty much every American beef company is using. And that beef emissions factor is like super general. Beef is a high emissions material. There's a lot of variations in beef, actually, like beef yield, you know, like beef can vary quite a bit, geography to geography, breed to breed, you know, practice to practice as well, I imagine. And so it doesn't make sense that there should be one factor. Almost certainly, we're going to have hundreds of PCFs related to beef being generated and exchanged over the next couple of years, like next, you know, 1 to 3 years. It is a certainty in my mind that there will be hundreds of beef-related PCFs. So you already have this proliferation of actual supplier-oriented data replacing the one general emissions factor that was used.
And how does this change how businesses are going to conduct supply chain engagement?
I think that it is going to nudge businesses are going to find that the places where they have the weakest secondary data, the weakest emissions factors that are also material, are going to be the places where they want to push hardest on supply chain engagement. And so when we talk about hundreds of thousands of factors, emissions factors being created, the place where those are actually going to be created is all the white spaces probably first, and all the spaces where there's like one or two factors and very insufficient coverage, but there is also materiality. And I think that those PCFs are going to be seen as interchangeable to some extent with EFs, but also just better, like interchangeable in how they're used, but better in their provenance, almost, because you can actually say, well, this is closer to the truth.
I'm Isabel Wild. Welcome to the State of Sustainability podcast, a show for professionals transforming corporate sustainability strategies, brought to you by Altruistic. Emission factors, as we know them, are over. This is a punchy statement, I know, but whilst we're trying to make a stir, we also see a bit of truth in it. So today we're going to be unpacking just what we mean by this and how you, our listeners, can prepare. Seth, I can see you itching in your seat to jump in. So over to you.
Yeah, I don't think emissions factors are going to be over anytime soon, but we could get to that, Izzy. We could get to that. I wonder if we should start with some of the headlines, because it's like all headlines. There's a headline a minute right now.
And let's do it.
Yeah.
Should we start off with Bezos stopping the funding towards SBTI?
Punchy. So that's like today's news, I think, or yesterday's news, depending on kind of when we publish this. I was intrigued to read that for so many reasons. So where I heard about this was the FT, and one of the pieces that the FT mentioned was how there's speculation that Bezos Earth Fund, which used to be the most prominent funder, I think, of SBTI until now, I guess, that one of the reasons for them pulling out was, or the main reason for them pulling out, was actually this sort of Trump skepticism around climate change, and that Bezos personally wants to align more closely with Trump's agenda, and therefore SBTI was a bit of a distraction there. I think that's really interesting. I also wonder whether there was any element of this whole backlash against SBTI that happened last year around SBTI's position related to offsets and credits and so on. I don't know if that created just the kind of noise that Bezos didn't want to be associated with. I don't know if the whole thing just became a bit too messy and you add in the new political environment, and actually then maybe as if you're Jeff Bezos, you start to wonder, do I really want to be in this? What I am thinking now, though, is I'm wondering how much this is really a bad thing, actually. Like, we were sitting here, Izzy, a year ago or thereabouts, and we were probably thinking to ourselves, you and I don't know if we verbalized it, but we're probably thinking, oh, look at this SBTI corporate overtake and people like Bezos basically bankrolling and getting their way with standards. And now we've kind of got, I guess, what we wanted in a way. There's obviously a problem here, which is how does SBTI get funded? I think it is a good thing in general for an SBTI to exist. I think it is a good thing for an SBTI to get better, and therefore I do want it to get funding. I would just rather it be funding that is either more ideologically aligned with what SBTI used to stand for, or at least funding that is quite detached from corporate interest. And so I'm keen to see what happens in the fallout or next steps on this.
Do you think it's going to leave a vacuum for other players to jump in on, or do you think actually standardization won't be as necessary?
I think there's like the piece around a vacuum related to funding, and there's maybe a piece around vacuum related to pressure, like who's going to be pressuring SBTI to move in a particular direction now. On the funding side, it can sometimes be a challenge when a big funder leaves. And usually that's when you have one funder who is outsized and the organization has ramped up spending and ramped up its programs to meet the ability of that funder to back it. And I actually have faced this recently with a nonprofit that I was involved with, where we had probably two funders that were outsized versus all of our other funders, and one of them pulled out. And as a result, we just had to downsize one entire program of that organization because it just didn't have funding. So like a third or more of the organization, you know, was impacted by that. I haven't looked closely into what SBTI's headcount is, what the, you know, just how big it's grown on the back of Bezos Earth Funding's financing, which I imagine would have been significant because the sums that Bezos was giving out in form of grants and support to nonprofits were very substantial funds. And so I do expect that it is going to be very hard to replace Bezos Earth Fund. There are probably only two or three nonprofits that could be at that scale, I imagine, unless a smaller entity wants to really step up and kind of make this its flagship program. So I think there is that gap that we're going to see SBTI try and fill somehow.
Yeah, I'm also intrigued to see where the funds will be allocated that haven't gone towards SBTI. Maybe they'll go towards something which is equally as important and can help scale into like a recognizable business that SBTI is. So there could be some actual benefits from reallocating funding.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting to see because Bezos Earth Fund was like intended to be a sustainability vehicle for sustainability funding. And its leadership was also from the sustainability community and its advisory board and so on. You know, like it was really a dedicated vehicle. And so I do wonder if you're not going to do stuff like SBTI. Maybe SBTI was just too close to the corporate regulation space and the corporate kind of, and that side of things is more difficult to square with MAGA. I don't know. Maybe there are other areas that are less controversial, like maybe something like wildlife preservation, national parks. You know, often those things can be less controversial.
Yeah. Seth, on to the second headline, which is Trump's dropout from the Paris Agreement. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I don't know if we've touched on this enough in previous episodes, but I was with Anthony Scaramucci yesterday. I didn't think I'd be saying this on this episode. And for anyone who's kind of not familiar with Anthony Scaramucci, he was the White House press secretary for 11 days, Juan Scaramucci. And I'm a big fan of the Rest is Politics USA podcast, where he's one of the co-hosts. And I was actually asking him what he thought the general trajectory would be on the US government's approach to climate change and whether actually like the sort of the federal position would be a short-term thing that would shape the next 4 years only, or whether it was actually more of a seismic ideological shift that we were seeing represented in the US and that would be there for, you know, a decade to come. He had a really nice response to that, which is he said, look, the states are going to take matters into their own hands in the US, and actually you're going to start to see many individual states just taking action themselves. And, you know, at times that's going to be at odds with the federal government and at times not, but it's probably going to drive just how the US as an overall entity approaches this sort of problem. And I think that with the Paris Agreement, we already now have this precedent for the US pulling out and then coming back in and now pulling out again. So there's potentially a chance the US is back in a while later. I think that we are probably overdue to revisit the Paris Agreement in general. Like when we start talking about 1.5 degree scenarios, I just wonder how long do we continue to hold ourselves to something that everyone is starting to recognize is just, you know, just a pipe dream. Like I would almost rather we have something pragmatic that everyone can agree to and align on and work towards and have a solvable approach, just have a, like an actual solution, rather than we keep flip-flopping over something that actually probably is slipping out of our grasp anyway. So I think it's sort of due a revisit. If the US is not happy to go along with this, what is the US sustainably happy to go along with? Same goes for Indonesia and all the other countries now that are talking about pulling out.
I guess would the US even be, in my humble opinion, I don't think it's as much of the 1.5 degree target as by the impact of pulling out of the Paris Agreement does for Trump's persona or what he's standing for. Because I think his whole stance is around climate change and that not necessarily being the biggest driver to all our worries that we're seeing. So I don't know whether the Paris Agreement is actually just a bit more of like a metaphor for his wider ideological take versus the actual specific target.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think a lot of this is about the noise and the symbolism. If you look at the last Trump tenure, you actually had some really meaningful decarbonization happening in relative terms with the growth of alternative energy, but just lower emissions intensity energy sources, which includes gas when you're shifting away from coal, for example. And I think there's a pretty solid chance that continues to happen over the next 4 years as well, despite the big focus on growing the energy share of market that the US has. So I kind of think we're going to see what happens over the next 4 years. I don't think the impact of them pulling out of Paris is going to be as substantial relatively as the impact that this administration in the US is having on other areas of policy. Like if I look at USAID, for example, just to give a left field example, USAID has been a mainstay of the development aid institution globally or industry or economy globally for decades now, and has been one of the largest funders of many development projects around the world. And I don't know if you already saw this, Izzy, but like as of this week, the whole entity is basically frozen. So all grants are frozen, everyone has been sent home, and they're effectively trying to wind down the whole organization. That kind of stuff, I think, is almost, again, relatively speaking, just much more radical, because whether the US kind of meets Paris Agreement goals or not is in some ways so distributed across so many different actors in the US, private and public, whereas you have all these massive steps that this government is taking pretty rapidly to stuff that is relatively quite clearly in their control.
Right, let's move back across the pond to the EU. And the EU is about to drastically simplify the sustainability reporting landscape with the EU Omnibus Regulation. Seth, can you give us a taster of what that is?
So Omnibus is basically, there has been a push that is not new, actually. There has been a sort of a movement within the European community to tone down, refine CSRD requirements. And this is not something that's happened just in the last couple of months or even couple of years. We've been hearing about this well before CSRD was approved, where there was just so much back and forth and so much talk of the onerous nature, let's say, of the CSRD requirements and how this should be limited and made easier and so on and so forth. The movement has been particularly strong from Germany and from a few other actors in the EU as well. Where we now are landing is that in the current environment where you have massive trade tension potentially between the US and Europe, there's a big incentive to actually now change the sort of CSRD requirements, narrow the scope, simplify the reporting and so on. So if I kind of reflect on what the big changes are, we're looking at a 25% reduction in reporting requirements for larger companies, and we're looking at a 35% reduction for smaller ones. So a lot of smaller suppliers to large companies are just getting carved out of some reporting requirements. Mid-cap companies, which have 250 to 1,500 employees, are going to have a lot lighter obligations. Some disclosures are going to become optional. And there's the potential that's been introduced for some deadline extensions of 1 to 2 years. And then the big thing is probably also just merging CSRD, CSDDD, and EU taxonomy into a single framework. I think that some of this is net positive. I'm going to start with the positives. I think some of this is net positive, which is I actually think it is very helpful to merge CSRD, CSDDD, and EU taxonomy. I think there was a lot of confusion and just overlaps. And frankly, like, I think we can all agree that in general, more streamlined regulation, more streamlined, simpler reporting requirements are better, as long as we don't compromise pace of change and momentum and so on. I think it is in everyone's interest for this to just be easier for business. When it comes to excluding these smaller or mid-cap companies that are 250 to 1,500 employees, I don't think that the inclusion of these companies or exclusion is going to move the needle a huge amount. And I say that for two reasons. One is often these companies are not very impactful anyway. Often they might even be like service businesses, just not very emissions heavy. The ones that are higher emissions intensity, I actually think will end up being captured anyway, either by virtue of voluntary disclosures by their investors, their customers, or by required disclosures and the momentum that that creates from their investors and their customers and so on. So I think we'll end up seeing some of those companies indirectly captured anyway, and other companies not that impactful. I think there is a piece around how much does this change the urgency with which the larger companies, let's exclude those small mid-caps now for a moment, does this impact the pace of change that the larger companies were going for? I don't know. I think we're going to see. I think this is still an evolving piece. I think there's still a lot of speculation on whether there's going to be more than this, more than what's conceived. I think it's going to be something we're going to have to keep an eye on. From the conversations I've had with food businesses, at least, when I speak with sustainability teams and leaders in their organizations, I do see a general step back is maybe a big framing, but I would say that most of the players that fall into two camps, either those that are very US-centric or those that are a little smaller, tend to be consolidating what they're doing on sustainability as a result of the current political and regulatory environment. What that means is that they are planning to talk about stuff less and planning to maybe do fewer things. They may still be planning to do those few things to the same extent. So if they were running a region ag program and it was a serious program for them, maybe they're still doing the same program to the same extent, but they're actually saying, we're not going to go out of our way to try and redesign how packaging is used in our organization, for example. Like they might just be having fewer things on the menu. And I think that that's also just, you know, in some ways a good thing. More focus, more pragmatism can be a good thing. I think it's not the pace of change that any environmentalist would want. I think we'd all like from a system level more pressure to change rather than less.
Seth, 30-second answer, but do you think the sustainability bubble has burst, even from those top three headlines?
I was actually going to say, yeah, if you put it that way, yeah, I would definitely say the bubble has burst. I was actually going to say, I think the bubble burst last year, maybe, or maybe even the year before. And I think that there's a really clear reason why the bubble burst. The bubble came about because, in my view, of a low cost of capital, low interest rates, and low interest rates made a lot of initiatives seem viable. And a lot of future cash flows from initiatives seem attractive. And so you could actually kind of say, well, what are all the things that we could do if money was cheap? What are all the things that we could do in a high growth environment? And actually, I think that a lot of that is just looking quite different today. And as a result, it's not just sustainability interventions, there's more pressure on a bunch of stuff. So I think to that extent, the bubble definitely burst some time ago. I don't think we're seeing it burst now. I think this is almost the after ripples. At the same time, the bubble kind of didn't necessarily help things in a huge way. Like you sort of have these peaks multiple times over the last 20, 25 years where everyone has thought, okay, great, we're taking climate seriously now. Now there's going to be real change. You know, let's not forget there was like Kyoto, that was a big deal. There was Paris, Paris was a big deal. Glasgow looked very promising. And, you know, so there have been a lot of these sort of peaks. And actually, the truth is that the world keeps getting worse. Like it is getting hotter. It is having more exposure to extreme precipitation, more exposure to extreme heat waves. So the physics of it are not necessarily improving at all. And I think that means that where we will inevitably end up, I believe, is where this issue just continues to trend long-term more and more important. So if you think of it almost like, you know, parallel with the US stock market, actually, which is a nice parallel, right? The US stock market has, over the last 20, 30 years, had lots of dips. But overall, it's continued to kind of just track upwards. And I think that sustainability awareness and sensitivity is just going to continue to track upwards because of the physics. And you may have these like peaks and troughs within that trending as there's a fad or a, you know, a new political movement, but the physics of it just mean that inevitably we will care about it more and more over the long term.
Okay. Well, I feel like we ended on a bit of more of a positive note then. I was worried in the middle of that we were going down a dark tunnel, but thank God. On to emission factors. I'm just going to quickly strip it back to what is an emission factor, and then Steph, I'm going to get into the weeds of
this controversial opinion is, are emission factors over? So an emission factor in its simplest form is a value that quantifies the amount of specific greenhouse gases per unit of activity or material consumed. It is something that you're going to multiply against a unit of what you make or what you do. It's typically expressed as a CO2 equivalent per unit of activity. So for instance, per kilometer driven or per unit of fuel burned or per ton of product manufactured. But there is serious lack of standardization in the name convention. I mean, I think even in our podcast, we've spoken about an emission factor, an emission coefficient, environmental impact factor. Like the list goes on, but Seth, before we get going, what term should we be going by and why?
I actually use a few different terms. I use emissions factors with any audience that understands what I'm talking about. I use environmental coefficient with an audience that might not understand what I'm talking about, because that's kind of what it is, actually. It is a coefficient in an equation that you're using. I also just think about it from a data perspective as like a reference table, effectively. It's like a reference table which you're pulling coefficients from and multiplying against elements of data from your business. But emissions factors works for anyone who's in this space. What's tricky, actually, at some point in our business, I think we've actually walked away from this. We tried to really start referring to them as environmental factors rather than emissions factors, because we actually kind of see water factors being relevant as well. And you could have nature factors, right, or biodiversity factors, like you could have a range of different factors as you pull them out. And many of these are all derived from LCAs, which might actually include the potential for multiple factors to be pulled out, not just emissions factors. But that didn't catch on even in our business, it seems. And so we're back to emissions factors.
Emission factor it is. Seth, when I first said emission factors are over, I could, for people who are listening, Seth was like wincing and cringing in his seat. So I want to get your opinion on like how businesses are currently using emission factors and actually how is this set to change?
Oh, this might take more time than we have. But if we put it simply, most businesses that have been new to measuring emissions will probably have outsourced this problem, let's say, to a consultant or otherwise. And the emissions factors that were used in their calculation would probably have been fairly few. By fairly few, I mean maybe several thousand factors would have been in the database that was leveraged. And of those several thousand factors, it could well be the case that only a few hundred factors were actually applied. If you think of what that means from an emissions calculation perspective, let's say that I am first time doing this, I'm a small or mid-sized business, I have basically an Excel spreadsheet or I have a tab in a spreadsheet, and that tab has 100 line items, and those 100 line items are a high-level categorization of everything that I've done in my business. So I have a category for tomatoes, I have a category for potatoes, I have a category for all the other macro-level ingredients of soup, which is maybe what I'm producing, right? I have tomatoes and potatoes in this soup and leeks and all the other things that go into a good soup. And so I have maybe 10, 20 ingredients, and it doesn't matter how many batches I'm buying these in, how many places I'm buying them in, I just have 20 line items. And the other 80 line items are all the other things that I'm buying or using or doing, etc. And against those 100, I need to find emissions factors to use. And maybe I have 100 emissions factors that I match against my 100 line items. That's your carbon calculation, basically, at its essence. And you now say, well, there's also an element around what is the logic that governs the matching, so I know which emissions factor I'm matching, and what is the logic that governs the calculation, because actually maybe there's some nuances there. And as this has gotten more complex, what's happened is that people have wanted more accuracy and more precision and more flexibility and more analytical power behind this. And they start saying, well, 100 line items is actually not sufficient. I have a million transactions going on in my business. I have 1,000 different activities. I have 10,000 people doing stuff. This is not 100 line items. This is more like 100,000 line items or a million line items, actually. And I'm not going to need 100 emissions factors. I'm going to need 10,000 emissions factors, because now for those tomatoes, I need 20 different factors for 20 different places I'm buying tomatoes and 10 different varieties as well. So that's 200 tomato factors alone, for instance. And that then drives you towards this interesting complexity in what databases you might be using. And so like at Altruistic, we have somewhere between 25 and 30 different databases, I think, that we license and we kind of pull together and we aggregate. And then we've built our own data sets on top because we found a lot of white spaces And so we have a couple of 100,000 emissions factors in the full database that you can leverage and that can be matched to activity data using a custom logic or a customizable logic. Sorry, that's the 3-4 minute version, something like that, or 2 minute version of emissions factors. Yeah.
If truth be told, I got a bit lost in the potato tomato soup at one point there, but I'm glad that I got there in the end. So how are these emission factors? So when people are looking for greater accuracy, greater volume, greater quantity of emission factors, how is this going to change how people use them and actually procure them?
So we could obviously have multiple episodes on emissions factors, but I think the interesting thing that I want to talk about right now, at least, is where does IP sit in emissions factor land? And where is value in emissions factor land? And I think that there are these two schools of thought. One is that the value is in the factor itself. And you could have a proprietary factor. And right now you have proprietary factors. You have like EcoInvent emission factors, or you have World Food LCA database emissions factors, or, you know, there are different companies building their own factors as well, much like we've built some of our own factors. And so we could, you know, let's say have an altruistic branded, the factors that we've created could be altruistic branded, and we have 10, 12,000 altruistic own brand, you know, altruistic's finest emissions factor, for instance. And you could then say, well, the IP is the factor and the branding behind the factor, and that you trust the brand behind the factor, and that this factor is credible. And if you're in the tomato business, you want to have the company that has the best emissions factors for tomatoes, and altruistic's finest is the brand for you, you know, on the emissions factor side. And I think the other school of thought is actually the brand is not going to be in that, because you can't police that. Actually, if those factors get shared around, you know, let's say that your ChatGPT is now has access to these factors and is happily sharing them willy-nilly with anyone asking, you know, what is the emissions footprint of a tomato in Spain? Potentially, actually, there's no value in the emissions factor, which is just a number, hard to police the IP, potentially quite fungible, actually. It's a scientific output, which means that it's hard for me to really say that the emissions of something is 1.67, and I have patented that, or I've copyrighted that, or that 1.67, no one else can claim it to be. You have to claim that it's 1.68 or 1.66. You can't stake your claim on 1.67. So I think there's an inherent challenge in IP around the emissions factor. The next place is actually, it's the framework, it's the methodology, it's the process by which you generate the emissions factor, where the IP sits. And actually, anyone should be able to use that framework, or like, you know, with the proper, whatever it is, like licensing fee or approach or whatever. Like some people have tried to patent the framework, but the logic is then that the framework or the methodology is what is proprietary. And actually, anyone should be able to use this to spin up lots of factors. And then, you know, the factor is what the factor is. I think that's a little more plausible, but at the same time, I think that we're moving towards a world where actually everyone recognizes that it is in everyone's interest for methodologies to be open source and transparent. Sustainability reporting and regulation orients towards disclosure. It orients towards making clear what is happening and how it's happening by its very nature. And I think an essential part of that is to say, this is the methodology that was used to derive these numbers. So I think the direction of travel is actually that you can't really patent those things. There is really no IP, which means if the methodology to get the number is free for all open source, actually emissions factors, I think, very quickly become a commodity. And so I think that this world that we're in right now, where I know a lot of databases are trying to charge for factors and charge higher and higher license fees to extract value, I actually think that it almost accelerates the movement towards commoditization of factors, because it creates an incentive for all the other stakeholders to turbocharge efforts to open source methodologies, frameworks, and emissions factor creation. So I think we're going to end up with hundreds and hundreds of thousands of emissions factors on an open source framework or methodology. And that, it kind of, in a way, destroys value for the emissions factor vendors. Altruistic's finest will almost certainly not be an emissions factor brand, but it creates a lot of commons value, or a lot of value for everyone else.
All I could think about was the M&S advert. This is not a normal emission factor. This is an altruistic, succulent, accurate emissions factor. But Seth, what about emissions factors that people are creating from their own supply chain and their own data? What will happen there?
I think that we will need to have some level of comparability where we can say, well, this product carbon footprint that we've acquired is as good or better than the emissions factor that we were using that was general. And I think that in some pockets, in some categories, maybe not pockets, pockets suggest it's too small, but in some categories, I think that the product carbon footprint world will very, very rapidly outpace the emissions factor world. Let's take a good example. There's basically one beef emissions factor that pretty much every American beef company is using. And that beef emissions factor is like super general. Beef is a high emissions material. There's a lot of variations in beef, actually, like beef yield, you know, like beef can vary quite a bit from geography to geography, breed to breed, practice to practice as well, I imagine. And so it doesn't make sense that there should be one factor. Almost certainly, we're going to have hundreds of PCFs related to beef being generated and exchanged over the next couple of years, like next 1 to 3 years. It is a certainty in my mind that there will be hundreds of beef-related PCFs. So you already have this proliferation of actual supplier-oriented data replacing the one general emissions factor that was used.
And how does this change how businesses are going to conduct supply chain engagement?
I think that businesses are going to find that the places where they have the weakest secondary data, the weakest emissions factors that are also material, are going to be the places where they want to push hardest on supply chain engagement. And so when we talk about hundreds of thousands of factors, emissions factors being created, the place where those are actually going to be created is all the white spaces probably first. And all the spaces where there's like one or two factors and very insufficient coverage, but there is also materiality. And I think that those PCFs are going to be seen as interchangeable to some extent with EFs, but also just better, like interchangeable in how they're used, but better in their provenance almost, because you can actually say, well, this is closer to the truth.
And so do you have any advice for professionals who are directly or even indirectly using EFs?
I would say that I think that a lot of sustainability professionals don't really get under the hood enough in terms of what the emissions factor choices are. I think a lot of them can get quite involved in querying the data once it's calculated and then trying to drill down into what emissions factors were used and why and so on. This is when they're working with solution providers. But I think there's also a process of just understanding this in more depth upfront, like what types of factors will be used, where will these factors come from, what is the methodology behind them. Let's go category by category, actually. What is the coverage for beef or chicken or whatever might be material? And then, you know, if you kind of start identifying that early, you can start to frame almost like an emissions factor strategy, a data acquisition strategy. And there you could say, well, where do I need better secondary data versus where do I need better primary data or closer to primary data from suppliers? And I've seen companies that have tried to explore everything from building their own modeling capability to running supplier engagement programs, where actually acquisition of another set of emissions factors from secondary data was easier and quicker and more verifiable. And there might be situations where actually it's one of the other two.
Awesome. Thanks, Seth. Well, I feel like we've covered a lot today. We've hit the headlines pretty hard, three biggies. We then got a handle on emission factors, whatever their name may be, how businesses are using them, how this is actually set to change in terms of commoditization of emission factors, and then also an emission factor strategy. In the next episode that's coming out, we've got Beth Jones talking about supply chain engagement, where we're going to dig into a little bit more about how your supply chain engagement strategy can change to accommodate this new shift in how we're looking at EFs and supply chain specific emission factors. Seth, are there any other points or thoughts at the top of your head that you want to mention before we say goodbye?
No, nothing else to add from my side. I'm all good. Thank you, and thank you to our listeners.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye.